This is a recording of the Michael Lerner conference call with Common Will on Friday, December the 16th, 2005 at 11 o'clock a.m. Central Time. Okay, Ms. Sotos, go ahead.
Okay, can everyone hear me?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, great. So I'd like to introduce myself. I am Eleni Sotos. I'm the National Coordinator of the Collaborative on Health and the Environment. The moderator for this call will be Elise Miller, Executive Director of the Institute for Children's Environmental Health and the coordinator of the CHE Learning and Developmental Disabilities Initiative. Before we begin, I'd like to cover some important logistical information regarding this call. Please note that everyone on the call, with the exception of our guest speakers, has been placed in listen-only mode. At the conclusion of the presentations, the operator will unmute all the lines so that you may participate in the question and answer period if you so choose. To be mindful of the process during the Q&A period, please identify yourself before you speak, and please keep your comment or question brief. Please note that the call will last 1 hour. It is being recorded, and an audio MP3 file and transcripts will be available on the CHE website at www.healthandenvironment.org for download over the coming weeks. I also would like to announce that the next month's national partnership call has been scheduled, and that will be on Wednesday, January 18th at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern. On this call, we will be discussing thyroid disease and environmental factors. I'd now like to turn the call over to Elise Miller. Elise, thank you.
Thank you, Eleni, and welcome, everyone. I know it's a busy time before the holidays, but I gather we have over 100 people on the call, so I really appreciate your interest. And I will now introduce all the speakers. Ted Shetler, who's the Science Director of the Science and Environmental Health Network, will provide some framework and context for the discussion today. And then we will have Dr. Virginia Rao, who's Professor of Clinical Population and Family Health at Columbia University, and she's going to be discussing her team study on neurobehavioral outcomes. Next will be Dr. Brenda Eskenazi, Director of the UC Berkeley Center for Children's Environmental Health Research, and she will discuss data on neurodevelopment in young children, focusing on exposure and birth weight. And finally, we will have Dr. Margaret Reeves, who's a senior scientist and program coordinator for the Pesticide Action Network of North America, and she will discuss exposure, farm workers, poisoning policy, and activism. So we have a great lineup, and I will now turn it over to Ted.
Thanks, Elise. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Yeah. So I just want to make a few brief comments to sort of frame this conversation. Many of you on the call know this, but just to remind us that pesticides are regulated by the EPA under the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act. And when a pesticide is newly developed, the company that intends to market it must register it with the EPA. And as part of that process, a battery of toxicological assays is required as part of the application process. Pre-market assays are done with the active ingredient, the pesticidal compound. In real life, active ingredients are often combined with other chemicals in the final formulation. Non-pesticidal substances in the final formulation are added as solvents or surfactants or for other purposes that influence the behavior of the pesticide in the environment where it's applied. These other ingredients are usually labeled as inerts on the package, although they may actually have their own biological activity and toxicity. That is, they may not really be inert at all. The assays required are done in validated animal tests. They include looking for acute, subacute, and chronic toxicity, genotoxicity, cancer, and reproductive and developmental effects. Earlier this year, immune system effects were added to mandated testing of newly proposed pesticides. Effects in fish and birds are also examined. One assay that is not mandated for pesticide registration is neurodevelopmental testing. That is, what's the effect of the chemical on the developing brain? The EPA has the authority to require such testing, and they do so on a case-by-case basis. Several years ago, the EPA issued a data call-in for developmental neurotoxicity testing on a series of pesticides that have been on the market for a number of years. Those testing results are slowly coming into the EPA, considerably behind schedule, and some, but not all, are publicly available. There's a large literature on the health effects of pesticides that includes not only the toxicological testing of the chemicals in laboratory animals, but also many epidemiologic studies in exposed populations. There's a good summary of this literature that was compiled by the Ontario College of Family Physicians in 2004, and it can be found on their website. Just a couple of comments on the principal findings in their review. They noted many positive associations between pesticide exposure and various kinds of cancers, which were outlined on the, in their report. They also remarked about a consistency of findings of nervous system effects from pesticide exposures, and they also commented on, particularly in occupationally exposed populations, birth defects, fetal death, and intrauterine growth retardation. Today's call is going to focus on neurodevelopmental effects of primarily one group of pesticides. These are the organophosphates, a family of about 20 to 25 insecticidal chemicals widely used in agriculture. Organophosphates were first synthesized and used as nerve gas in World War II, but since then their chemical structures and properties have been significantly modified to alter their toxicity and other physical chemical properties. But they're all neurotoxic. That's how they work as insecticides. And their impact on the developing brain has been a topic of intense interest in recent years. One of the perennial problems with epidemiologic research into the impacts of pesticides or other chemicals is often the lack of good quantitative exposure data. On today's call, we're going to hear about two interesting ongoing studies of the developmental impacts of organophosphates in infants, where both exposure and outcome data have been carefully collected. These are the kinds of studies that will be necessary in order to examine for neurodevelopmental impacts of pesticides and other industrial compounds in people. And finally, I should also just point out that there is now accumulating evidence suggesting that early life exposures to some pesticides also increase the risk of Parkinson's disease later in life. And there's considerable interest in how early life exposures may increase the risk of other neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia. So I think I'll stop there, Elise. Thanks.
Yes, I'm not sure. Is there a segue to the next speaker? I'm the next speaker.
I think Elise Miller must have been cut off.
So I'll bet she was, yeah.
Please do proceed.
Sure. This is Virginia Rao, and I am going to be presenting results from the Columbia Center for Children's Environmental Health, which is part of the NIEHS EPA-funded network on national centers for children's environmental health. In the Columbia study, we have focused on a cohort of about 700 mothers and their newborn infants, largely inner-city minority families. Approximately three-quarters of the families are Latino, and approximately one-quarter of the families are African-American. This is a cohort that has been followed currently for approximately 7 years. We have plans to continue the prospective nature of the study. This is a study that looked at the impact of ambient pollutants on growth and development and behavior through the early years of life. The exposure that was mentioned by Dr. Shetler is one of the exposures that was our principal focus, the organophosphate pesticides, in particular chlorpyrifos. We measured chlorpyrifos exposure in pregnant women during the second and early third trimester of pregnancy. It's important to understand that during our period of study, chlorpyrifos exposures actually changed in this cohort due to the EPA ban, which took effect on 12/31/2001. At that time, the residential use of chlorpyrifos and some other pesticides was banned, so that our study participants were no longer able to purchase these products. The good news is that following this period, we saw lower exposures in cord blood for chlorpyrifos exposure prenatally. Several things prompted us
to look at neurodevelopmental effects in the children with the prenatal exposures. The first is we originally saw a significant effect, an adverse effect, on birth weight. This consisted of an approximately 150-gram deficit in birth weight among children who had high chlorpyrifos exposure prenatally. We were concerned that this type of growth retardation might translate into neurodevelopmental effects. As a result, we followed children over the next few years of life using the Bayley scales of infant development. This is a test which is widely known and widely normed. It's particularly useful for identifying children at the low end of the developmental range, that is, those children who may have some kind of developmental deficit. In this case, we found that by 3 years of age, children with high chlorpyrifos exposure prenatally had a developmental deficit in motor development. They also had an increased risk of motor delay at 3 years of age. This means that the odds of motor developmental delay among those kids who were exposed to chlorpyrifos prenatally was approximately 5 times the risk of children who had very low chlorpyrifos exposure. Similarly, the odds of mental developmental delay, according to the Bayley, reveal that approximately 2.5 times the number of children with chlorpyrifos exposure revealed developmental delay, which is scoring under the score of 80 on the Bayley developmental scale. In addition, we saw some neurobehavioral effects among those children who were highly exposed. Specifically, using the child behavior checklist, we found that a significantly higher number of children at the age of 3 manifested symptoms of attentional disorders. According to the DSM-IV, attentional disorders can be of the hyperactive or the inattentive type. In our particular cohort, it looked like the chlorpyrifos-exposed children had higher rates of the inattentive type of attentional disorder. This is consistent with other studies of certain kinds of neurotoxicants, in particular tobacco smoke and a range of other things, lead, other types of heavy metal exposures that have been well studied. These findings are somewhat worrisome in that they suggest that early developmental effects may persist and may become more apparent as children develop their repertoire of behaviors. We expect to follow this cohort of children for the next 4 years to determine whether or not the early effect on motor development and the effect on mental development and the impact on behavioral functioning will persist into the early school years.
Thank you, Dr. Rao.
Thank you, Dr. Rao.
Elise, you're back on.
Yes, I'm back on. The conference call service seemed to have inadvertently disconnected me, and it took me a while to get back on, so my apologies. That was excellent. And so we next have Dr. Brenda Eskenazi.
Yes. Good morning, everyone, or good afternoon. I'm from the University of California, Berkeley, and I'm going to be talking about our research for the Center for the Health Assessment of Mothers and Children of Salinas, or the Tremaco study, which is the key study of our Center for Children's Environmental Health Research funded by the NIEHS and EPA, and a sister study to the Columbia study. The aims of our study were to estimate the sources, pathways, and levels of in utero and postnatal pesticide exposure of children living in an agricultural community. We were to determine the relationship of pesticide exposure and neurodevelopment, growth, and respiratory disease. And we aimed to also understand the mechanisms how pesticides might affect children and human health. We also have, as a part of our center, which I will not be talking about today, interventions to reduce exposure to children whether or not we find positive health effects, we also want to clean up children's environment, and we are working with our communities to develop interventions to reduce take-home exposure from farm workers to the homes of children. The area that we're studying is about 2 hours south of the Bay Area in California. It is an area of intense agricultural spraying. Many of you probably are aware of the Central Valley. The Central Valley is a much larger area than the area that we're studying. But the intensity, that is the concentration of pesticides, is actually less than in the Salinas Valley. The Salinas Valley is also an area where farming occurs about 11 months a year. So we were able to include in our population a fairly mobile farm worker population that's relatively stable compared to the Central Valley, and where we can follow the children. In terms of the kinds of pesticides that are applied, organophosphate pesticides, that is, in the Salinas Valley, there are about 500,000 pounds of OP pesticides used in any given year. Some of these pesticides are known endocrine disruptors and therefore could affect neurodevelopment through multiple mechanisms. Probably the leading number of pounds used in terms of OP pesticides is diazinon at about 130,000 pounds in 2001 during the year that our children were born. And malathion was also leading. Also, one thing I'd like to say in regards to what Vinny just talked about in New York City, when chlorpyrifos and diazinon were banned for home use, they were not banned for agricultural use. And we actually saw an increase of diazinon during the period after the home ban in terms of agricultural use. So what pertains to what Ginny talked about does not pertain to the agricultural setting. Also, the pesticides that we're talking about are more than 25 different pesticides, probably 40 different pesticides where we have a considerable number of pounds of application. Our study population comprised 600 pregnant women who were living in the Salinas Valley. They were Medi-Cal eligible, and we were trying to get primarily the mobile farm worker family population, so they're mostly Latina. They plan to deliver at community clinic, community hospital, and we're seeing at community clinics. And in California, you do receive prenatal care even if you're undocumented. In terms of our longitudinal birth cohort study, women were interviewed multiple times during the pregnancy, and we did neurodevelopmental assessment at the time in the first 2 months after in the neonatal assessment tools using the Brazelton. We also assessed the children at 6, 12, 24, 42, and currently our children are 5 years old, and we hope to follow them to 7 years. We also did home inspections and collected dust samples, so we know what the exposures were in the dust as well. And we are currently doing respiratory spirometry functioning, and we'll be looking at school performance. We've also collected about 50,000 biological and ambient specimens from urine, blood of the children and the mothers, breast milk samples, saliva samples, and as well as environmental samples. And, of course, many of those samples have not been analyzed, so I'll be talking about just a fraction of those samples. As I said, there are about 50,000 in storage. The characteristics of our mothers, most of them, 92% of them are Spanish-speaking. Almost all of them were born in Mexico. They are living in poverty. About half of the women worked in agriculture during pregnancy, and 84% had agricultural workers in the home. I will now be talking about the exposure measurements. Unlike the study at Columbia, our primary exposure measurement was using dialkyl phosphate metabolite levels. There are 6 dialkyl phosphate metabolites that's supposed to represent most of the OP, something like 80% of the OPs that are used. We're in a different exposure scenario than in New York City, where they primarily focused on a couple of pesticides. In an agricultural community, you've got multiple pesticides, and this was a way to get at the final common pathway of all of these different exposures. However, exposure measurement of the OPs is problematic, which I hope to get into in a little bit. In terms of our exposures of our pregnant women, the exposures during pregnancy were considerably higher, statistically significantly higher, than the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. CDC also did a random sample at the same time of women, not necessarily pregnant women, around the United States, and our levels in our agricultural community are significantly higher. We have found, unlike the study at Columbia and another study at Mount Sinai, no relationship with our pesticide measurement and birth weight. We did, however, find that women with higher levels of organophosphate metabolites, particularly dimethyls, for example, a dimethyl pesticide might be malathion or oxydemeton methyl, and shortened gestational duration. However, there was no relationship with birth weight. The third study, which is not being represented today, also did not find an association with either birth weight or gestational age. And one of the curiosities, which we have discussed in past calls, not necessarily with this group, why there are differences in relationship of different measurements of OPs and fetal growth and length of gestation. And it may have something to do with not only the types of measurements, blood versus urine, as well as the particular mixture of pesticides that are being used in the different communities that we're discussing. So again, we find a relationship with shortened gestation. We had to...
Dr. Eskenazi, can you just wrap it up in the next minute or so, please?
Yes, I can.
Thank you.
We are particularly interested in the relationship with neurodevelopment, and we did find that there was a relationship on the neonatal, Brazelton Neonatal Behavior Assessment Scale, with newborns having more abnormal reflexes as the prenatal DAP metabolite levels increase, particularly, again, the dimethyl metabolites. So, again, we see a dose-related increase in neonates having abnormal reflexes. We are currently looking at the relationship of both prenatal and postnatal dialkyl phosphate metabolite levels in the mothers and in the children in relationship to neurodevelopment at later ages, and we are also looking at the relationship of different genotypes, for example, the PON1 genotype, and how it might modify the susceptibility and the relationship of exposure and neurodevelopmental outcome. We are also looking at thyroid toxicity because the ways in which pesticides may affect neurodevelopment may be via thyroid. I think I would like to wrap up by saying one more thing, and that is we are seeing few studies with actual exposure measurements. The exposure measurements are difficult to interpret, and they may reveal little about chronic exposures of children or of pregnant women, whether you use blood or you use urine. The same problem lies. The other thing is there is a growing number of animal studies which are beginning to look at complex mixtures. We are seeing very high levels of organochlorine exposures in our population too. The combination of exposures, I think, is really where our research should be headed in the near future. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Eskenazi. It's very useful to have these emerging studies both in urban environments as well as the farming communities. So we'll next turn to Dr. Margaret Reed. Dr. Reed.
Hi, thank you. Yes, I am at one of the staff scientists at the Pesticide Action Network, North America in San Francisco. So I will talk just briefly about some of the work we're doing regarding exposure, mostly among the farm, in farm worker communities. And as Dr. Eskenazi pointed out, mentioned both acute versus chronic exposure, and so that's important to keep in mind in terms of what we're looking at. At any rate, I'll just make four brief points. About one-third of the reported cases of acute pesticide-related illnesses among California farm workers are associated with exposure to organophosphate, OP, and carbamate neurotoxic pesticides. But we know that underreporting is a huge problem, and we know many, perhaps most cases, never get reported. As long as doctors, workers, other affected individuals fail to report, the problem essentially doesn't exist, and hence there's little incentive to eliminate pesticide use and exposure. In other words, I'm speaking on behalf of the opponents for reductions of pesticides. We don't hear about cases, so it's not a problem, so why all the fuss? So one of the big focuses that that we have is reporting, and that it's essential that acute exposures get reported. Along those lines, the people and the pieces are lining up in California for a legislative push to require laboratory reporting of all cholinesterase tests to a centralized authority. Cholinesterase testing, which is one of the only easily available tests for relatively high levels of acute exposure to OP pesticides and carbamates to some extent, has actually been mandated by the California legislature for the past 30 years, but the system is quite non-functional because there's no access, essentially no access to that information. Following Washington State's implementation of a similar cholinesterase testing program called medical monitoring, they actually had tremendous results in terms of access to information that could then be used to evaluate what's happening in terms of exposure, and that I think is part of the initiative for behind moving forward on something like that in California. It's still in the very, very preliminary stages. We're not sure who and where and what is, how it's going to move forward, but that's in the works. Also at the national level, it's important to remember that EPA's OP risk assessments are not yet complete, and so there's still opportunity for input, and as was pointed out, chlorpyrifos, for example, although it's been banned for most domestic uses, is still used very widely in agriculture. And it also is a big focus of the Pesticide Action Network's drift catching projects. We have created a tool called the Drift Catcher, which is an air monitoring tool that we can actually put in the hands of community members who are interested in not only documenting airborne exposure to chlorpyrifos or other pesticides, but are actually interested and willing to do something about that in terms of policy change. And so chlorpyrifos has, in fact, been a focus of some of that. And then finally, the fourth point I want to make is that biomonitoring, of course, is an important component in efforts to document exposure. Already mentioned was the extensive CDC biomonitoring program. PAN has provided analysis of the pesticide-specific part of the CDC data with emphasis including neurotoxic pesticides, including chlorpyrifos, lindane, and others. And we also have a current community-based project doing both drift catching, as I've mentioned, the air monitoring, and analysis of chlorpyrifos metabolite in urine in a farm worker community in California Central Valley. That has been a bit problematic in some of the logistics, but we are optimistic that it will move forward. And this BioDrift project is a project of PAN, Commonweal, the California Coalition, Californians for Pesticide Reform, which represents about 180 groups around the state, and a community group in the small town of Lindsay, California, called El Quinto Sol. And in part, this project is designed as a model. How can other communities, if they're interested in doing this kind of biomonitoring, learn from our attempts to put this project together? So I think I'm just going to leave it at that, mentioning some of the things that we're working on, and perhaps in the question and answer period there'll be more opportunity to expand.
Thank you. That's excellent, Dr. Reeves. And so now we are going to turn to the question and answer period. And, operator, can you put everyone in the talk-listen mode?
Yes,
please?
1 moment.
Thank you so much. And in order to keep the ambient noise down, if the rest of you, if you're not planning on talking or while we're hearing other questions, if you could self-mute, this always creates a little orchestra on the phone, by pressing *6, and then if you wish to, if you think we're there.
Lee, I'm just sorry I came in late. I had to be on another call, so I missed I'm just going to listen in for a while.
Dr. Lee, thank you so much for joining us.
But I'm sorry I wasn't on earlier.
Well, and obviously you're welcome to ask some questions or make some comments as we go into this next section. I welcome questions. And please announce your name and affiliation, please.
This is Sandra Steingraber at Ithaca College. I'm going to ask a question on behalf of who is on this call. He is an environmental activist living in Galesburg, Illinois. He also has ALS, so he communicates through written word rather than spoken word. So he has emailed me a question, which, keep in mind, he formulated before having had a chance to hear this. So I'm going to read this question, and I think it's probably directed at any one of you, as it involves a biomonitoring question. His question is, what do the speakers think about using the CDC report on human exposure to environmental chemicals as a model to investigate the levels of over 100 chemicals in patients with specific conditions, such as Parkinson's or ALS? And he has calculated that a minimal study with 200 patients and 200 controls at $3,200 per person would total $1.28 million for the lab analysis. To lower the cost of a study like this, he asks, this is a sort of part two of the question, could the existing CDC data for over 2,000 people serve as the control group? Another cost-lowering option might be only to investigate a subset of the CDC list of chemicals. That's it.
Thank you, Sandra. Who would like to respond to that?
I could respond somewhat. This is Brenda. I think that what he is proposing, or what you're proposing, is a case control study of ALS and controls. Is that what I'm hearing?
Or Parkinson's, you suggest.
Or Parkinson's. The problem, again, is the exposure. We're not talking about, I'm well aware of the measurements that CDC does, since they do our measurements as well. The problem is that except for the organochlorines, you're talking about transient exposures that may not be correlated over time, even in a community like an agricultural community where there's steady pesticide usage, or even in home environments, because that will be seasonal as well. And so you'll be getting current levels of exposure to transient chemicals, which may not reflect the exposure during the critical period when the disease began, or if one knew it. So I think that's the problem. I think it's a noble attempt, but I think it's not like working with dioxins or organochlorines where they have to be very long.
Thank you, and thank you for that question as well. So other questions, please.
This is Suzanne Werfel with EPA's regional office in Denver. I'd like to ask our speakers to comment on the fact that EPA has so far made its decisions on organophosphate pesticides primarily on the basis of cholinesterase inhibition under the assumption that this is the endpoint that's the most sensitive. So I'm wondering if our speakers could comment on the possibility that developmental neurotoxicity might occur at levels of exposure that do not cause cholinesterase inhibition, or even by a different mechanism.
Who would like to respond?
Well, this is Virginia, and I would defer to Brenda if she has some thoughts about this. There's certainly, Ted Slotkin has suggested that some of the damage may occur by at least two different mechanisms. So I think the jury is out on that, and I would definitely agree that we should be looking at levels that are considerably lower than have been offered in the past.
Yeah, I would concur that there are probably multiple mechanisms that are involved here. As I mentioned, I think some of these chemicals are endocrine disruptors. They may work through the thyroid. There may be, when we're dealing with developing organisms, we may not see acetylcholinesterase inhibition to the levels that would produce neurobehavioral effects in adults. So I'm not sure that those should be the only markers.
Just as a reminder, on our next call in January, January 18th, we will be focusing on thyroid, and I suspect that this question about the impact of pesticides on thyroid will come up on that call as well. Other questions?
Yes, this is Ann Greenlee calling from LeGrand, Oregon, with Oregon Health and Sciences University. My question is for Margaret Reeves concerning the BioDrift program that you have and the issue that Brenda brought up about the inability to capture those exposures that happen close to the exposure. And I'm wondering if you're adding that to your study where the community members are able to collect information on the drift, but then what about the exposure to the people? Are they providing blood or urine close to the time of that drift exposure?
The idea for the project is that, actually a couple things. One is that we also collect food to exclude, if that's the case, that source of exposure, so foodborne source of OP exposure. So the idea is that we collect air samples during a week period, near the end of which we do the urine sample. So the idea is it possible to actually correlate airborne levels and metabolite in the urine? And frankly, we had problems. It's a very small sample size, so it's very much a pilot project, limited funds, of course, and all the rest. But we had an issue with the lab results in that the minimum level of detection was substantially higher than what the CDC lab was, for example. But even there, comparing several studies, the null results that we got from the lab seemed very questionable. So we're working out some of that. But the idea is that, yes, we do both air monitoring and metabolite sampling at the exact same time.
And then once you have those findings, then what sorts of community action are you thinking about as far as interventions or political sway?
That's the next big step in that. There's a important component of this project, which is working with the community organization to identify what their priorities are and what the possible scenarios are. So the kinds of things that people are looking at is buffer zones, neighbor notification. Some of the first steps are plans to meet with the local county agricultural commissioner, and there's a organized program of migrant families at the school system. So that's one way around which they can get the knowledge to the community. So it's impossible at this point to figure out what it is the community wants to do about it, but we are working with an organized group and helping them to be organized around it. So we'll see what the outcomes will be.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Great. Okay, other questions, please.
It's Lauren Vanderlyn. I'm from Toronto Public Health. I have a question for either Dr. Rao or Dr. Eskenazi about whether, and thank you very much for your wonderful studies. We've relied on them a lot here in Toronto in making the case about health impacts and needing pesticide bylaws. But I wonder if there's any plans for any similar studies that would look at impacts from exposure to pyrethroids as being, you know, kind of the new frontier of insecticides that are more widely available for residential use and in lice treatment.
Can I respond? We do have measurement of pyrethroids in the house dust, and we're hoping to get pyrethroid measurements as well in biological specimens. So we are expanding to pyrethroids, but again, we also are looking at organochlorines because of the high levels of exposure.
This is Virginia. I would just add that we also have a number of pesticides that we haven't analyzed yet. We're doing our lab work in conjunction with CDC, and we have a little bit of a backlog, but we will also be taking a look at the impact of some of these other pesticides.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions?
This is Lynn Cannon from the Learning Disabilities Association, and as I understand it, both Dr. Rao's project and Dr. Eskenazi's project only look at children up to the age of 5, and I wondered if your work at that age correlated with the work with the direct work of pesticide studies in Mexico, and also whether there would be any possibility that your work could be extended, for example, to age 10. To look more closely at the cognitive impact that it can have on school-age children.
I'll take that question, Lynn. We're currently following in the New York sample the children until 8 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
I may not have made that clear. and we do hope to continue following them until at least 10 years of age so that we would have access to more of the early school age kinds of measures. Mm-hmm. With respect to other, with respect to the Mexico study, and that's the Gillette study?
Yes.
I don't know exactly what their ranges of exposure were. We had a range of exposure to chlorpyrifos ranging from non-detect, which was about 6.2 picograms per gram, up to 63 picograms per gram. And we were looking at the highest quartile of exposure, and that is the place where we saw the most significant effects. We think that the with respect to neurocognitive impact, there are many other areas of attentional disorders and learning disabilities that we can expand our work into. And as the children become older, we have, of course, it's a cohort study, so we have completed published findings by the age of 3, but we have considerable numbers of children who've already matured through the age of 5. And we're expecting to do more clinical assessment of attentional deficits and maybe some additional physiological assessments of attentional problems. So we are hopeful that by looking at more detailed aspects of the neurodevelopmental deficits, we'll have a clearer idea about hypothesized mechanisms and could propose additional studies in the future.
Can I respond to that question, too?
Is this Brenda?
Yeah.
Yeah, great.
One thing I guess I didn't make clear as well, these are both birth cohort studies where the children are aging, as we are, and so we're also, our children are 7 years, we have money to follow the children up to 7 years of age. They are now 5 years old. We just haven't finished the data analysis for the biomonitoring analysis of as far as 5 at this point. The children are currently 5 years of age. A new exciting study that we're about to begin is a parallel study in Mexico where the children from our community in Salinas come from a few different states in Mexico. We'll be recruiting children from those same states at the same age, at 5 years of age, looking at neurodevelopment and pesticide exposure in Mexico, so given that our children are mostly Mexican-American. In terms of one other thing I didn't mention is we're also not only looking at cognitive functioning and behavior, but we're also looking at autonomic nervous system functioning because we're concerned about the effects of pesticides not just in cognition but also on respiration and cardiac reactivity and reaction to stressors that involve the autonomic nervous system. So we have developed mechanisms and ways of studying the autonomic nervous system.
Well, thank you. I look forward to seeing the results of your studies.
This is Michael Lerner. A question that probably includes Ted Shetler, but for any of the speakers, where could a policymaker or an interested layperson find a summary of not only what is known, but what we are concerned about the broad impact of pesticide exposures on human health, both in terms of developmental conditions, degenerative conditions, just the whole range of them. And this has been a wonderful description of the challenges of the real research. But for a policymaker or for an interested person, what could we say about both, just in a sort of a broad sweep, about what our concerns are on broad impacts of pesticide exposures on human health?
Well, this is Ted. I would just refer again to the summary that was provided by the Ontario College of Family Physicians in 2004 as one place to go for a summary and a bibliography and a description of some of the challenges in drawing conclusions from the epidemiologic studies, which include, the adequacy of exposure assessment as well as controlling for confounders and a variety of other things that make this kind of work extraordinarily difficult. And I think that implied in your question is this notion that, you know, when you begin to see the signals that really do stand out in the epidemiologic literature, they're probably very real. Because there are a lot of issues that are conspiring to find false negatives. So I think that summary is probably as good as any to lay out sort of the case in the literature as it is. There may be some updates to particular parts of it since then, but that's a place to start.
And Ted, just one follow-up question. You distinguish between the efforts to assess what happens in individual health, why one of us gets ALS or Parkinson's or whatever, and then the public health questions that are addressed through epidemiology, and then you distinguish ecological health as a third level of analysis. If you look at the issue of pesticides from the third level of ecological health analysis, are there people who are trying to put together the totality of the animal experiments, the wildlife observations, the human health observations in a synthesis about what all of those literatures tell us about the effects of pesticide exposures?
Well, I think you find attempts at that in a couple of places, but probably in the sustainable agriculture literature and activities, you will find that systems overview represented as well as anywhere else. You can find in that literature critiques of the industrial agricultural model. You can find critiques of ecological impacts, economic considerations, and those are left out, but I think that's probably where one would look.
Thank you, Ted. I think we might want to include a couple of these URLs for the Ontario College of Family Physicians and the references you just made in the notes, if that's possible. So we'll contact you afterwards about that. Did Dr. Rao or any of the other presenters want to respond to Michael's question?
This is Margaret. I think Ted did a fine job. I don't have anything else to add. But there's a lot out there, but I think what you're looking for is concise summaries, and I think those are probably the best places.
Thank you.
Great. Another question.
Yeah, this is Claudia Miller from University of Texas. Wanted to know a little bit more about the use of the pond screening, and I think Dr. Eskenazi mentioned that they were examining that, and mentioned the fact that Clem Furlong's work looking at some of the alleles that if one is homozygous for those particular alleles and they put them in a rodent, that the rodent might as well be null for peroxynase. It just has no ability to metabolize the stuff. And so, this was actually the I think the chlorpyrifos oxynase. The question really is, I mean, the concern is, what about people in the population being especially susceptible because of the inability to metabolize these things? And then, you know, are we then seeing increases in some of the neurobehavioral problems that people are very much concerned about, whether it's autism or the things that were mentioned earlier, ALS, Parkinson's? I think we really need to be looking at this simultaneously.
I absolutely agree. This is Brenda. In fact, we have a grant to do just exactly that. We have just analyzed with Clem and Clem Furlong and Nina Holland in our group. We've looked at a number of different polymorphisms as well as in five different enzymes in both the fetal cord blood as well as the maternal blood. And what we see, these are two papers, one's in press, one is under review. We have seen a very wide range of potential susceptibility to OPs, with the children being, of course, more vulnerable because they have lower levels of the peroxynase, and therefore they're going to be potentially more susceptible to pesticides. This remains to be seen by looking at it in relationship to exposure and health outcomes such as neurodevelopment, but we are about to look at that.
Yes, this is Margaret. I just wanted to add one comment. It was brought up much earlier, and that is sort of the reminder to us all that much of the studies are focused on, or especially with regulatory and now are assessments focused on active ingredients, missing the inerts and quote-unquote inerts. Another issue I wanted to bring up is that of the metabolites themselves, some of the metabolites having being even more toxic, apparently. And so can anybody address that issue as well? So there's both chemical mixtures and the metabolites.
Anyone want to take that on?
Well, I can just say something about the metabolites. There's been a recent study which has suggested that we are exposed to the metabolites, the dithiocyanate phosphate metabolites, that it's not just that urine levels that we're getting in humans may not just reflect their metabolism of a parent compound, but actually exposure to the metabolites. I don't know of any studies that have specifically looked at the relationship of exposure to metabolites and health outcomes, but maybe in animal studies.
Thank you.
Great. We have about a little less than 5 minutes for a couple more questions.
This is Michael Lerner again. Two questions, one for Elise. Elise, as the director of the Learning and Developmental Disabilities Initiative, many of the developmental issues are concerns of partners in that initiative. To what degree in the LDDI calls and process have you addressed pesticide issues specifically, and to what degree have your partner organizations, the Learning Disabilities Association and others, formulated responses, either collectively or individually, to the pesticide issue in terms of policy concerns or other initiatives?
Thank you, Michael. And we did actually have Dr. Eskenazi on one of our Learning Developmental Disabilities Initiative calls, I believe in September. And so we focused on some of the research that she is undertaking on that call. We also have responded, at least those members in LDDI who've been interested. We wrote a letter regarding Lindane with the help of Pesticide Action Network in drafting that letter, and a number of LDDI members, including the Learning Disabilities Association and the American Association on Mental Retardation, signed on basically recommending and encouraging Lindane to not only be phased out of agricultural use but out of pharmaceutical use because it is used for lice on children's heads still. And I'll also mention that Lynn Cannon from the Learning Disabilities Association, who asked a question earlier, developed as the head of the LDA of Iowa a short video on thyroid condition and those links to learning disabilities, and that also highlighted some of the pesticide issues. So there's been a number of different ways that we've gotten into this subject, and clearly there are more opportunities we'd like to bring up in 2006.
Elise, this is Lynn Cannon.
Yes.
And we do have a resolution that was passed in 2003-2004 on endocrine disruptors, pesticides, et cetera. So,
and you mean the Learning Disabilities Association of America?
Yes.
Right.
We distribute this freely to anybody and everybody who will take it, and I would be happy to mail some copies to Chase so that they can use it at their discretion and respond to it in any way that might need updating.
Great, thank you. And is the resolution up on the LDA's website? Can we link to that?
You know, I have to check that out.
Okay.
See,
well, we can talk later.
I am not certain that it is on the website, but I will send you a copy, and I will request that it be put on the LDA website if it is not already on it.
Excellent. You know, we have only about a minute left. Is there another brief question?
This is Sandra Steingraber. I'll throw out one of my own questions quickly.
One of the most common questions I get from the public is evidence for harm for exposures occurring in school-aged children. So apart from the question of following cohorts of kids whose prenatal and perinatal exposures we've documented and then looking at their outcomes, I think that this, the spirit of this question is that if parents who couldn't deal with thinking about environmental harm when they were pregnant, but now that their kids are in school, they're interested in thinking about these things, and they might want to get like organic food in the schools or get their kids' playgrounds to stop spraying the soccer field. So could anyone tell me if we have some exposure studies looking at school-aged children and OP pesticides, but is there evidence for harm for kids who are exposed at that age?
This is Margaret. With nothing concrete to add, there's a lot of coming out around asthma, especially in California Central Valley, and apparently a lot of links to chemical exposure and other, not just pesticides, but pesticides are included in the mix. And I don't know who to connect you to, but that's one body of literature that's being developed.
Great.
Okay. Thank you. We're going to have to actually wrap up here, and I just want to thank all of our presenters and then the excellent questions that people asked, and I want to now turn it over to Eleni for wrap-up and a reminder about our next call. Thank you to everyone, and happy holidays.
Thanks, Elise. I just want to quickly remind folks that our next call is scheduled for Wednesday, January 18th at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, and we will be looking at thyroid disease and environmental factors. So I'd like to thank everyone, and happy holidays, and we look forward to our call in January. Take care, everyone.